Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Hello, this is Chaos Radio, this 6th international edition. We are about to talk about big games, and we are going to talk with Kevin Slaven, who is with us today. Your host, as usual, is Tim Pritlove. Say hello to Kevin. Hello, Kevin.
And I say hi in return, Tim.
Yes, fine that you're here and that we finally have the opportunity to talk, because you are busy in interesting things that I think are really interesting to look at. Well, your life seems to be a life of games somehow. Is that true? How did you... what's your way of
it is,
having
it is,
games in your life?
Yeah, it is now a life of games. There were a bunch of years leading up to this one that were spent in advertising, which led to certain kinds of interests that we're still pursuing. But in a way, as we're moving forward with the way these games work, I've come to realize that really this is a direct continuation of work that I was doing as an artist many years ago, and that even as an art student, my sort of training, as it were, was with Hans Hacke, who's a German artist who lives in New York, and as a sculptor, what we were learning about was the idea of systems themselves as the subject of work, the idea of building situations and systems rather than objects, that the dynamics of the world were more interesting than the things necessarily that those dynamics produced.
What was your first computer?
My first computer?
Yeah.
My first computer was a VIC 20.
Okay.
3000.
Did you play much on it?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your favorite game?
On the VIC 20? I think the most notable game I remember is the one I remember most clearly is Blue Meanies from Outer Space, and I remember really clearly because it was the first time I could start to understand the code that it was written in.
Okay.
And also what I remember quite fondly with the games on the VIC 20 was that most of them came from typing them in by hand out of these computer magazines, and that was just the most amazing way to learn how things worked, you know, was that you actually had to knit this thing together, and then you saw this thing that you had produced, but actually somebody else had dreamed it up, right? And there was this very weird, and you would have to debug the whole thing, right? Because you were always typing something in incorrectly, and I can't remember the names of any of those games, but that's where I spent all my time, because it was from that moment on. It was once you typed in the game and once you were playing it, it was like, okay, what could I do with this? You know, like how can I tweak it? You know, like what can I do with this game to make it a little bit more this or a little bit more that? And that was great, you know.
Yeah, I remember those times where you constantly, and then you were also enhancing the game, because you were really learning that whole software development process of taking something that's already there, enhancing it, and probably even find bugs that are in there.
Totally, yeah,
problem
yeah.
was yeah. free of bugs.
Yeah. Yeah, it was always amazing to me that they couldn't find a system to generate the final finished debugged code and publish that. But in a way that was great training. I mean, you know.
Right. So right now you made games, your business, your living. I don't know how well it works, but can you shortly describe what you're doing now?
Yeah. So I have a company called Area Code, which my partner in that is my favorite game designer, and that's Frank Lance. And Frank, among other things, used to be the director of game design at Game Lab. And while he was there, even before that, he had done some of my favorite games that were out there, and really, really innovative, you know, and not. You know, not like, you know, more levels for Splinter Cell, and not like, you know, the sequel to, you know, Road Rash 5 or whatever, but actually like, you know, real games that had ideas in them in terms of how they play. I had been looking at some of the work that he'd been doing originally with Jan Abrams at the University of Minnesota. He did a game called The Big Urban Game, which involved transforming the city of Minneapolis into this enormous game environment, right? And they had these huge, you know, 30-foot high inflatable playing pieces that people were hauling around Minneapolis over several days in response to stimulus from the internet. Basically, everybody was playing, right? And then that would create the moves for the players who were moving these things around. And that I had seen that and had really kind of tagged it as I don't know if this is what the future of the medium looks like, but this is clearly a totally different idea about what games can do, which is to actually transform the urban experience. Through a very weird set of circumstances, Frank, that had partly to do with me long before Frank and I even met each other, Frank ended up starting a class at NYU where he teaches in big games. So some interesting projects came out of that. Pac Manhattan is the most famous one. And I was working at an ad agency and was dying to sort of see if we could pull something off, you know, for one of our clients that really, you know, use this, because basically, you know, the funding model for this is unclear, right? You know, it's and we're sort of building the business and we're trying to figure out what that business is. But the most obvious one and the certainly the short term one is basically sponsorship in a sense, right? And you know, companies that sponsor them and then these games that really work to do good things for their brands.
So you already mentioned this Pac Manhattan game, mm-hmm, which sort of was like the most mostly reflected on. What kind would you? Can you describe what you did and why you think it was the most successful one for you?
Yeah, I should start by saying that my personal involvement with that was I didn't have any personal involvement with it, but it was Frank's class, which included. Some people who really went on to do some really interesting things, even way outside of that. It was actually the first time that big games had ever been taught as a subject. His students had come up with the, sort of based on what he was bringing to them about work that he'd done thus far, they came up with the idea of using Lower Manhattan and its grid structure to actually play out the game of Pac-Man in, you know, physical, three-dimensional, real, you know, street life Manhattan. One of the things that happened with it is that they had been planning to really use the most complex set of technologies possible to track the location of the human Pac-Man and the four human ghosts running around the city.
So to describe it probably a bit more, Practically. So people were actually moving in the streets.
Right, there were five,
So everybody was a Pac-Man?
There were five players, four of which play the ghosts, you know, Blinky, Pinky, Inky, and
Fly. Oh, they got names?
Yeah, they've always had names.
Oh,
yeah, they've always. Yeah, maybe they were just in the States. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, they were never really addressed by name, but anyway, they had names. So four players are the ghosts, and one player plays Pac-Man. Mm-hmm. Pac-Man is running through the grid, which is more or less modeled after the grid from Pac-Man. And if there is a dot, if one of the dots is still determined to be at his location, then he eats that dot. And if there's not, then
so
he just keeps going.
Who played the dots?
Nobody plays the dots. Data plays the dots.
Like, why is nobody playing the dots?
I mean, that's a good question. You have to get very small people, I suppose.
Beautiful people, beautiful girls. Beautiful
right? Yeah,
boys.
It could be. Maybe the next iteration is just people playing the dots, and you have to knock them down. But then who would play the power pill? Really, that would be the real.
You can hand out melons, for instance. That's a totally untapped concept. Like that, Pac-Man has actually to eat these.
right. Yeah, that's actually the next step. The idea of it was that, you know, Pac-Man would be running through eating the dots, you know, that are determined to exist on this grid. And if he ate one of the power pills, then the ghosts would turn the ghost clothing inside out so that they were blue.
But how did they know? I mean, how does this technically happen?
Right, and that's what's interesting. So when the students first thought about this, they had thought about it using GPS and all these, you know, we'll use SMS out to let the ghosts, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? And it had, I think, at one point, you know, like five or six possible points of failure. You know, it's like five or six systems built on top of each other. And then anyway, you know, GPS in any city, but in particular Manhattan, because of the height of the buildings, is just it's a losing proposition. You know, there's just, you're always going to have these urban canyons where, you know, the satellite signals are bouncing off and et cetera. So one of the things that really came, you know, most directly from Frank was to really say, like, look, this is not about the technology, right? This is really about, you know, the possibility of making this happen. That there's a fundamental layer to this, which is that we can communicate with people that we can't see, right? And that we can both be in motion when that happens, right? And that, I mean, it really, it's not more complicated than that for Pac-Man Head. So really, all it was four or five people in a control room, right? Each one of whom was assigned to one of the players, right? So there was each ghost and Pac-Man himself had like an operator, right? Who they were constantly in touch with. And so really the game was sort of playing out in the control room, you know, with people kind of in a way moving around representations of them and then letting the ghosts know, okay, you know, you're blue now. Right.
Okay, but how did they communicate with each other?
Cell phones. Just cell phones.
Okay, cell phones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and that worked out? I mean, was
it? Yeah, it worked out great. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and it was amazing to watch and
who won?
Pac-Man, as far as I know, up until this point, because it's been repeated many times now, as far as I know, nobody has ever completed the first board.
Oh.
Which is, you know, sort of funny and interesting on its own. You know,
okay.
That Pac-Man Hatton is much more difficult than Pac-Man.
Difficult to find players.
No, it's easy to find players. Yeah, it's difficult to find time, you know, and it's difficult to find, you know, the resources in a way to, you know, get another five people to do the control room.
When I'm Pac-Man, I wonder, how do I make my decision where to go to? I mean, am I sort of, somebody's telling me where to run?
No, you're deciding where to run.
But how do I remember where the dots are?
Yeah, that's up to you.
Okay, so I have to have the map in my mind. So.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So the funny part is that you're actually putting the game into the city and you're sort of integrating the city itself. Are there any other examples that are worth mentioning in that context, what you've done with Area Code?
Yeah, the biggest project we've done is one called Conquest, which was for a phone company out west called Quest. And that was really the first game to really be done expressly for commercial purposes, essentially. And this was a game that took place in 10 different cities, so Portland, Minneapolis, Salt Lake City, Seattle, mostly cities in the West, Boise, Idaho, some really small cities in a way. And this was similar types of dynamics, but really its own ideas within that. One thing that's sort of most notable about Conquest was that we used a technology called Semicode in that. And Semicode at that time, and I guess this is 2000.
We're talking about the 2D barcodes here.
Yeah.
So basically pitched for use with Wikipedia and so on. Do you know about the Semipedia project, for instance?
Semipedia was done by Alexis Rondeau, who's my former intern.
Okay.
So that's the very direct link.
Okay.
It came in part from his looking at Conquest.
So the game was first.
The game was was first. Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, of note is that the game was the first licensed use of Semicode ever.
Okay.
And at the time, when I had seen it, I think on Simon's blog, the guy who invented it, you know, like I had stumbled across it, and it was not long after he had done version, 1.0. And just thought, that the power of a two-dimensional code, this thing that looks like an unfinished crossword puzzle, that the idea of that, within an urban landscape, something like it had a power because you look at these things and you could stare at them for 5 minutes, you could stare at them for 5 hours, and they yield nothing. It's like they will not give up their secrets to humans, right? But then there's a thing in your pocket that can read it, right? And just that essential idea was already very interesting to me in terms of its use for play.
So can you explain the rules a bit more? So
yeah.
How many people are playing it, and what is the setup? So what do I experience when I am the player, right, for instance?
So this game was designed for to use it was to be played by high school students, and so we had a promotions company that basically went to the high schools in each of these towns and recruited 25 kids from each of these five competing high schools. The kids, we armed them basically with phones that were not optimized to read the code, but were, they were
able
to. And so that everybody was on one platform basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the base mechanic of it, in a way, is treasure hunt dynamics, right? These codes were integrated into the cities, but when I say that they were integrated, I mean like they were really. It wasn't just like okay, we'll just slap them up somewhere. I mean, I did the most insane media buy in the history of media buys. It was like, I want this billboard on 19th Street in Maine. I want the top of this taxi, that's going to drive around here. I want to be in the window of this art gallery that's over here. And basically it was like flying out to the cities and finding where would you put a couple hundred of these codes so that they felt like, some strange virus had arrived within the city, that it didn't feel like street art, it felt like something had kind of woven its way into the code of the city, and that the thing that had woven its way into the code was really some weird kind of secret. I'd been really directly inspired by this movie from the early 80s, a really crappy science fiction movie by John Carpenter called They Live. And it was a really bad movie, but it was a really brilliant idea. And They Live was about a guy in L.A. who is he's quasi-homeless. He's having a really bad day. And he comes across on the street a pair of sunglasses. And he puts them on, and he looks up, and, and all of the ads that he sees, all the billboards, instead of, being for, like, Calvin Klein underwear or whatever crap, they say things like, obey, or stay asleep, etc. And then he takes the sunglasses off, and it's for underwear again. He puts them back on, and it turns out that all of the advertising of the world is actually sort of jamming it's sort of like a false signal on top of the real signal, and then it kind of spins out of control because it turns out one of the businessmen walking by has a giant flaming robot head if you have the glasses on, because the Earth has been controlled by aliens for
that. I didn't know that movie.
It spirals out of any control. But
okay.
It's such a beautiful idea, right?
Yes.
That there would be this like
Augmented reality.
Yes,
idea.
It was. And I mean, this is like 1983 or so, right? It was before we really had the language to even describe this kind of thing. But what I loved was this idea of the public secret, right? That there was this stuff that was out there that everybody could see, right? And it was like it was visible to everybody, but only legible to some. You know, like everybody could see it, but not everybody could read it. And to build a game around this dynamic, and to enter into American cities and create this situation where people are just walking around and there's just this crazy code. And then there's this moment when the game starts, when these kids who are playing are unleashed on that. And suddenly you realize that this is all part of the system. You know, that has now been activated. Right?
Mm-hmm. How many people are playing at the same
time? So a total of 125 kids at once.
At the same time. In many cities.
Sequentially, it would go from one city to another, like a rock tour without any sex or drugs or rock.
Okay, so in every city, it's like over 100 people. Yeah. So they're all going out to hunt the treasure.
Exactly, right.
And how do they find these SIMA codes? I
mean, they're just out there. They're, you know, it's the same in a way.
I mean, is it just small stickers somewhere, or
some,
is it like
some of them are small stickers? Some of them, you know, we did quite a few that were probably about. The codes themselves were probably about 10 meters high, you know, like really, really big.
Okay.
You know, like, you know,
like billboards.
Huh?
Like billboards.
They were billboards,
then.
Right.
Okay,
I mean, it's like, you know, it's like that was the ad.
Okay.
Right? The ad was just this raw code.
Okay.
There were on the top of taxis that would normally be advertising cigarettes or whatever it is, there would just be this code.
It must be some kind of restricted to a certain region, right?
Correct.
And actually that's the
second point about it is that the if all it was just a scavenger hunt or treasure hunt dynamic, that's okay, but that's not really an interesting game. It might be kind of fun, but it's not really that interesting. And that's why Frank came up with a really kind of brilliant dynamic that made it not about a treasure hunt. And what it was really about was territory. And this is where things got really interesting. So the kids who were playing were given maps of the city that we had basically carved up the city into 8 zones. So let's say it was happening in Seattle. We had carved up Seattle into 8 zones. They had a map of that, and they could see which zone belonged to which streets. In order for them to shoot the treasure that was in, let's say, you know, the team from, you know, Main Street High School wanted to shoot the codes in Zone 8, they would have to own Zone 8. They would have to occupy it, right? And so then there's a system of how you occupy that zone, and then there's a whole series of strategic decisions, right? It's essentially game board, right? You know, and whether you move north, south, east, or west is going to depend on what your opponents have done, right? So if I'm in zone 8 and I want to move into zone 1, what if my opponent is there, right? You know, then we're going to have to challenge each other, and there was a dynamic for that.
So finding when I find a SIMA code, what do? I take my mobile phone and scan it, and what's the information that's behind?
So I come across a SIMA code, and I shoot it with my phone cam. At that time, the SIMA code client was only written in for Symbian phones, which the phone company that we were doing it for didn't even have any Symbian phones. So we had to rewrite everything basically together with the guy who had invented SIMA code. Dennis Crowley did a lot of the coding, he did all of the back-end technology. Dennis is also the guy behind Dodgeball, which is a mobile social networking, social software, which is quite relevant to everything that we're doing. I think, you know, the Dodgeball and what we were doing with the game kind of helped inform each other in really positive ways. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it was written such that if we couldn't put a client on the phone to read the codes, what we would do is we would have the kids shoot the code, send it to our server as an MMS, do the decode on the server side, and that would
send an SMS back.
It would send an SMS back that said, Okay, you got that one. That one's worth 150 points, et cetera, et cetera. But the other thing that it was doing is that because we had placed all those SIMA codes everywhere, we now knew where they were, right? So if we got code number 903, Okay, we know, because we have our map, we know that code means that you're in zone 9, right? Or, you know, zone 3 or what have you, right? So if they weren't in the zone that they occupy, right, then that code isn't going to give them any points, right? So a lot of the strategy of the game was figuring out as a team, as 25 people who can't see each other anymore, right? And okay, you can communicate with any of them, but you can't communicate with all of them.
Right.
Right. And so then it's like, then we're getting into kinds of games that we've never really been able to have before, where it's really, you know, it's kind of, you know, where emergent behavior starts to happen, and where the kinds of strategies that you're going to have to play that kind of game are not hierarchical in the, you know, in the normal sense. You might have a captain who decides this is going to be the strategy we're going to use, but there's no, you know, running around telling each of the 25 people what they have to do. You know, really, it's about figuring out how do we ourselves figure out what to do. And some of the smartest players, it's, you know, if you give high school kids a chance to be really smart, they're really smart, you know. And they came up with, like, really, they would show up at the games with these really beautiful, like, organizational charts that would show who is responsible for knowing what and disseminating that information to whom, right? And when we started to see that kind of things showing up at the game, we were like, okay, we've made a great game. You know?
So they were really taking up on the idea and improving it even further.
Yeah, you know, and they started playing in ways that, of course, we hadn't even thought of, even though we play tested it. And that's another good sign that you've done something right, you know, that people have figured out what to do with your work that you never intended or imagined. They figured out how to cheat, and we had to figure out how to stop that. But that, you know, that's part of the nature of it.
Okay, one piece is still missing for me. When I find the summer code and I send the make photo of it, mm-hmm. send the MMS, what kind of information do I actually get back? What's inside this?
I would get an SMS back that says, okay, player, you know, 3 on Team Mountain Lion, you've just captured another code. That's another 150 points for your team, bringing you to a total of 1,200.
Okay, so it's just basically the high score, the scoring.
Whoever reaches 5,000 first.
Okay, but then I own that pug. I hate that. Sorry, I have to make a short break here. Okay, let me ask the following question. So, it's sort of like taking a computer game into the city. Mm-hmm. Thereby losing completely the original notion of a computer game, which basically means you are sitting in front of your computer and you're diving in some kind of world. Now the computer is coming into your world, so it's like augmented gaming in a way. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a certain quality. I mean, Chaos Computer Club has also done this blinking lights installation, which sort of also integrated the city into... It allowed gaming in a way, but it was much more about being integrated into the city.
Right, yeah, we had a big crush on that project.
You had?
Yeah.
How did you know of it?
Oh, because it's our job to know about things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the internet just, like, told you that's existing.
Yeah, I also know Berlin. So,
okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's your take on this?
As a general idea, I think one of the things that has happened to games is the same thing that's happened to computers, which is that it turns out that the real power of computers is not necessarily to compute per se, but really to communicate. It's really that it turns out that what's great about computer games now, like right now, is the fact that we can play them with millions of people. You know, like what makes World of Warcraft great is, you know, a couple things. One of them is that the world is so beautifully rendered and that we can create 3D images that do this, you know, that have this kind of power. That's great. But, you know, that wouldn't be much fun. It would not have the same kind of power if you weren't playing it with, you know, 4.5 million people, right? And if you look at, like, the grand history of games, like, never mind computer games, but just games, you know, there will be in the, you know, writing this from the future, there will be this, like, weird footnote, this weird historical moment that starts in, like, I don't know, 1980 or so, or maybe, you know, actually earlier, but, you know, maybe about 1980 to about, you know, 2000 or so, where people played games alone, right? I mean, you know, it's like people would be like, yeah, that's really weird. Like they used a computer as the opponent, right? Rather than the thing that puts me, you know, in touch with the opponent, rather than the thing that mediates all the exchanges that I have with the full sophisticated complexity of people. You know, like the computer was like trying to outsmart me and I'm trying to outsmart the computer, right?
But actually, wasn't the first Pong already to play a game?
That's true. Actually, that's an excellent point, right? And Space War, right? Space War and Pong were two-player games, right? And I guess if I think about it now, it's partly because the computer wasn't really powerful enough to be a worthwhile opponent yet.
But then it was.
And then it was.
Until
right?
it was too... Well, too complicated, impossible to beat.
Right, and I mean that's
where the
thing is
kicking in again.
You know, it's like I like to play chess, right? But and I play chess online sometimes against other people who I have no idea who they are. That's always going to be more interesting to me than playing chess against a computer, even one that's matched to my level, because a computer is going to play chess like a computer. And you know, if it's going to play at my crappy level, it just means that it's handicapping its math, you know?
Yeah, and there's no point in comparing brain cells to
processes. And what's interesting is how humans interact with humans, you know? And what's great is that computers are making this possible in ways that was never possible before. And really, you know, part of what we're taking from the video game world is just the capacity to play with all these people who I can't see, but I have a very meaningful relationship with for this hour that we are together in this space. You know, it's taking the kind of idea of cyberspace and pulling it back into the real world and saying like look, we're gonna have this, you know, shared hallucination of the space right in front of us, you mm-hmm. know, rather than you know, some dream of whatever. And a lot of times we talk about it is that, you know, these are games that have computers in them rather than the other way around, right? That if computer games have been thought of as trying to take you further and further into some like vanishing point on the screen, you know, like if you think about a first person shooter, like, you know, going deeper and deeper and deeper into, you know, this moment and, you know, of sort of like trying to simulate this world, you know, on a two-dimensional screen, and there's all kinds of tricks to deal with that. That if that's what computer games have come to mean, you know, it's like, well, what if a computer game is really just about, you know, allowing us to compute the real world in ways that we've never been able to compute it before, you know?
Have you been playing World of Warcraft?
Yeah, I play World of Warcraft. Yeah, not lately, but yeah.
But if you played it, you have been stuck for a while, I guess. Because most of the people I know are sort of gone for a week, you know, a month. Or
yeah, I was longer. Gone for about a month, I would say. Yeah, I had a little vacation.
So how was it?
it's amazing. I mean, and truly, like, the only reason I don't keep playing is because I just don't have the time. But you know, it's like there's all it's a good there's a couple of like concrete things to take from it. You know, one of the things that we look at is that, like, okay, there's a couple. I don't know if you play at all World of Warcraft, but
no, I never found the time. I was okay. Sort of scared of these online role playing games. Although I did play role games mm-hmm. Before without a computer,
right.
So I have some right. kind of attachment to it.
Right. Well, one of the things that's interesting if you sort of stop and think about it is that just the way people communicate within World of Warcraft, right? There's a couple different modes of communication, right? So if I do a say command, basically, then what I type is going to be visible to everybody within my immediate surroundings. Everybody who can see me on screen, which is, you know, has like, you know, conventional ideas of visibility, anybody who can see me on screen can see what I'm saying, can hear me, as it were, right? That's one way of communicating. I can also talk directly to anybody who we've agreed that we're in the, you know, that we know each other and we're friends and whatever. I can talk to them directly no matter where they are.
Okay,
right?
So you've got the telephone number.
Which is sort of like, you know, cell-to-cell communication. And then I can also, I can yell and broadcast out over the entire, let's say, nation scale of things. But also... I have guild communications, right? And guild is like, you know, I'm in a guild, and that means that there are maybe, you know, 40 of us who are committed to helping each other get through the game. And one of the things that's really such genius about the game is that it doesn't tell you you must join a guild in order to play the game or to win or what have you, but it produces situations where it's beneficial to do that and where it's fun and it feels very, very natural that at a certain point somebody extends a hand and says, come on into our group, you know, and we'll help you and you'll help us, et cetera, et cetera. And so once you're in a guild, you can also talk to the guild as you're running through World of Warcraft, right? And they may be online, they may not be on, there may be only five of them online, they may all be right in front of you, right? And the thing that's really interesting about that kind of communication is that there's no analog to that in the real world, right? I mean, like there's no way for me to just say, for example, we're here at this conference, there's no way for me to just talk to everybody at the conference right now, right? That would be a guild communication, right? You know, it's like we are all in this group together, you know, and we're all in the same vicinity, right? But if I wanted to talk to everybody at the conference, I'd have to call each person at the conference, right? But so if you look at World of Warcraft, you can see like there's different types of communications possible. And what we're interested in is like, okay, how do we take some of the dynamics that video games have in a way invented, right? And start to pull those out into the real world? Can we produce infrastructure that allows us to have guild-like communications, for example? You know, can we create an infrastructure that would allow me to have to talk to everybody at the conference, to take some action together, you know, to act in some common interest, right? And that's a very specific example, but it's to say that there are types of social dynamics that are possible in video games that we're interested in what happens when you take those out into the real world. And that's really possible now, you know, and that, you know, we're trying to invent them for play, but they don't just have utility as play. They have utility as every other type of communication has utility. But so that's that's one of the lessons from World of Warcraft.
I can only hope this is going to be really successful, because I'm sort of scared that all the shooting, capturing, destroying games are sort of making it on the streets as well.
Yeah.
But just imagine all this military stuff that's out there, people starting virtually shooting, or I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting to note that there's a game called Street Wars, which is done by a friend of ours named Franz, which it's basically a variation on Assassin, which we played in the 80s in high school and so on. It's killer. You have a target and somebody's targeting you and you shoot them with a water gun, which sounds really dumb, but it's super fun. And that has been revived now, you know, and it's really interesting that it went to sleep for many years. And it's really, really interesting that it's woken up. And I played it in New York, and it was amazing who else was playing, you know. And I, you know, recently I had breakfast with, you know, a really kind of important venture capitalist from San Francisco, and we were talking about whatever. And he said, yeah, I played Street Wars. I got killed in the second week. And it was like, yeah, you know, it's like this is it's somehow in the air. That the kinds of things that we're doing online, even the first person shooter type stuff, that you can start to pull that in to enter your real life, and you don't have to run around with a weapon and think about killing all the time, but it transforms your consciousness if on the way to work you're like, I really hope I don't get shot. Right? I mean, like, and it's so simple, you know, it's so simple and it's so powerful. How that affects your day, you know, right? Like, you know, it was like that thing of you know, sort of like looking, you know, looking out the window before I leave the house, you know, and that a game, which is really nothing more than a bunch of rules and some water guns, could actually transform your everyday life like that. That's powerful shit, you know. And
absolutely,
you know. And that's like a very it's not to put it down in any way, because it's a really amazing one, but that's like a very simple interaction, you know. That's like I'm trying to kill somebody's trying to kill me. But
and it's also usually creating a new community. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a social network in itself, but it's also usually that people are really starting to communicate about the game itself. I was once involved in creating, a multi-user game that you could play via the telephone, which it wasn't really a game. It was more like an environment, mm-hmm. a virtual villa where you could just enter and all the movements were controlled by the keypad of your telephone. But immediately when the people gathered, they started with playing their own games within the system, just right. using the infrastructure, talking to each other, leaving messages and communicating in a way. And there were right. some forms of communication like that, what you described, the mm-hmm. communication World of Warcraft, so mm-hmm. like talking to friends and so on.
Yeah.
No guilds, actually. But it was funny to see how they're really taking up on it and building their own community. And in the end, they were even marrying themselves. Didn't hold that long, but it happened. But yeah, games are strong. That's the yeah. the basic punchline.
Yeah, games are strong. And also, I mean, this is sort of the continuity between your Blinkin' Lights project and the kinds of things that we're doing. This is that we talk about, you know, the dawn of the kind of read-write city, you know, that like that cities for many, many, many years, as long as there have been cities, are basically read-only. You know, it's like, you know, who builds the city? You know, architects, developers, urban planners, et cetera, et cetera. And then we live in it, you know. And really, what was the platform to write back to it? There's not much. I mean, you know, okay, there's graffiti, you know, but there's not many other ways to feel like I'm using the city. Right. And that is also, that's the other powerful part of it. Part of it is the play element and the games and the community. But the other part is the idea of a city that you can use. You know, the idea, it's like where you start to think about all the buildings around you as the hardware. And, you know, I'm going to use it in the following ways. And that, I think, again, it's like that we're not inventing that. I think that's partly something that we've acquired a taste for that from video games, right? Because it's like when you're playing Grand Theft Auto, right? That you are affecting your environment. You're interacting with your environment in ways that you could never do in real life, and that's part of what makes it really fun, right? And so the question is like, what can we use all these new technologies to do so that you can affect your environment without actually altering it physically, right? That because there are ways to alter it. You know, they just don't have to involve, you know, leaving marks, right?
Right.
And you know, because I think that's, you know, it's part of what the essential impetus behind, you know, street art and graffiti and et cetera is just the idea of you know, that the city is just a little bit mine, right?
Yeah.
And that there are ways to do that where that can you can feel that way all the time.
Yeah, and you can yeah. fill it with content that's actually only existing on the internet, but you are attaching the meaning to it, and that makes it sort of playful. I mean, yeah. just think about leaving the semicode stickers mm-hmm. yourself.
Right.
By like dropping new information and, right. and making your environment a new adventure game in
right.
itself.
You know, and maybe it doesn't even have to involve leaving semicode. Maybe it's just marking a location for somebody else who may find that location, right? Because that's
yeah. You know. I mean, the geocaching community is sort of doing this already. I mean,
absolutely,
they're leaving the treasure. And this time, it's real treasures and
yep.
finding it.
Yeah,
it's sort of still very simple, but people seem really to be very attached to it. Also,
it's geocaching is really beautiful. You know, in part, if the alibi of geocaching is that I'm going to this location to get some treasure or whatever, that's not, I mean, I've done it. It's not what it's really about. It's really about somebody thinks that that's a special place. You know, it's like basically, it's not that people are hiding treasures. They're curating space, you know, and they're saying like, you know, here's the really amazing tip of City Island, you know, off the Bronx, you know, there's one where one of the 9/11 flights went down. You know, there's a geocache there, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, that's not about getting the contents of the Tupperware container, right? That's about going to that place, you know. And this idea of like, okay, we are able to curate the real world for each other, you know, that's amazing. That's never really been possible before. I mean, that came from like guidebooks, maybe, you know, it was like, you know, like from Michelin. You know, Michelin curated space for us, and now we can do that for ourselves, and that's amazing.
Yeah. So. Okay, I think that basically sums it up. What we have to say, although this topic is endless, as I feel, but I'd like to make a stop here. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Tim.
Kevin, for yeah. joining here.
Yeah.
And I hope we can continue this discussion at any time.
I have a feeling we will.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks Bye. To you, Tim. Bye.